from the mildew-ridden studios of WHYY in Philadelphia, it's time for another powdery hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks, you bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. On today's show, powdery mildew is a very common problem in American gardens, but it has some very uncommon characteristics. We'll tell you how to prevent its appearance and reveal some very strange ways to fight it off if it shows up anyway. Otherwise, it's a phone call show, cats and kittens. Yes, potential guests are busy buying milk, so we will take that heap and help it. Of your telecommunicated questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and resolutely righteous recriminations. So don't dare diddle with that dial. It's all coming up like you enjoying a day on the garden slopes without a foot of packed powder because you hose down your hostas right after this. Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, it is one of the most common diseases that can strike American gardens. But powdery mildew is perhaps the strangest garden disease, with many uncharacteristic characteristics and some surprisingly weird cures. You won't want to miss it. And you won't, as long as you stay tuned to the end of the show. In the meantime, that heapin' helpin' of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, thank you, John. How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm fine. My pawpaw trees aren't, but I'm fine.
And where are John and his pawpaw trees?
We're in the mountains of North Carolina, Mitchell County, Spruce Pine, North Carolina.
Okay, very good. So what can we do for John and his pawpaw tree? What's wrong, man?
Well, first of all, my pawpaws aren't bearing. Secondly, I have a small grove. Actually, it lies right at the side of a brook on a bit of a levee. I purchased a house a year and a half ago, and the center tree in the group of, I'm standing here counting them, in the group of six, is fairly large. It's about 15, 16 inches in diameter, and it's dying in the middle.
You say it's next to a stream or a body of water?
Yeah, I have a small stream from a series of springs that runs through my property.
Okay. You probably have a lot of underground water. You probably have a high water table.
Yeah, I do.
I'm going to guess before we even go any further that that's the problem. The pawpaw tree is a native to dry woodlands. Anytime you're in the woods, you may think that the shade would keep the ground moist, but the opposite is true. All those roots in a heavy wooded area suck up any moisture that's around, so that the trees that survive in the understory, like the pawpaw, tend to get by in dry shade, which is almost redundant, because if the shade is being cast by lots of trees, their roots are getting first choice of the water and perhaps second and third choice. So this is a tree that prefers to be drought stressed rather than waterlogged.
Well, it's right at the edge of trees. I have a cliff in back. Cliff comes down, stream runs along it. Pawpaws are on the opposite side of the stream from the cliff, from the 30-foot cliff. They have trees growing over them, but not around them.
Well, there's something going wrong in there. And you planted the pawpaw in this open area thinking, well, here's some low-hanging fruit. Here's a big space of ground I can use, right?
Well, no, I didn't plant it. I just moved here, and there it was.
Well,
I didn't even know what I had until I got a book on trees and found long-leaf magnolias, I think.
And so it's not your fault, John. Whatever's gone wrong is not your fault. You're off the hook.
Well, now, part of what I've attempted to do is to transplant the pawpaws. And perhaps I carried them on up the stream. I thought, well, boy, they must love being next to the stream. So I planted about six seedlings last winter, and only one survived, one fairly large one. And it seems it took it all summer to get any leaves, but I planted it next to the stream, so perhaps that's the problem again.
Yeah, I think we're going to be looking for, on your property, some high ground that's not waterlogged, where you don't see any water when you dig the hole. Now, whenever you plant any tree, I don't care what kind of tree it is, you never plant it too deeply. You always want to plant in a shallow hole, but a wide hole so that the roots can spread out. If the trees have any wrappings around the roots, you want to remove them completely. You want to backfill the hole with the same poor soil the tree is going to have to learn to grow in, and then you don't want to stake it or mulch it in any way. And trees typically do not need to be fed, especially chemical spikes or other salt-based fertilizers.
Okay.
Anything in there you can improve besides the different placement?
Yeah, I can quit feeding it because I did feed my transplants last year.
Oh, yeah. These are native trees, John, and they're kind of, in the best sense of the word, trash plants. They really don't need a lot of help from us. What they do need is a dry area, and especially while they're developing, a good amount of shade. Even though it seems counterintuitive to us, some of the best fruits are understory plants in the wild that don't get that much sun. Raspberries being the prime example. In the wild, you never see raspberries out in the open. They always grow around dense woods and shrubs and around trees and stuff like that. And pawpaws are especially prone to sunburn when they're young. They can take more sun as they get larger and established, but early on, they really want to be under the canopy of some other trees.
So I need to replant my whole grove, I think.
Yes, I would advise you to do it in the fall or the spring, not necessarily in the winter, because these things are going to flower in the spring, and they flower in pretty early spring. So, you know, should they start growing again after you plant them in the winter, they could get stressed. You could miss that flowering period. So the fall, if you can get the stock, the fall is the best time to put these long-lived plants in the ground.
Okay, great.
I think you're going to be eating pawpaws. I think we isolated the problem, and I think you're going to be in pawpaw heaven.
Okay, thank you.
Take care, man.
I appreciate it, Mike.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Jerry, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Mike, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I love your show.
Thank you for making it, Jerry, and I love that you love our show.
I'm having a lawn problem I'm hoping you can help me with.
And where do you live, Jerry?
I live in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, southeastern Pennsylvania, right outside of Philadelphia.
Excellent. You may proceed.
Well, we have extremely heavy clay soil here. It's always been a problem. But recently, did some work on the lawn. We redid some downspouts to get the proper drainage since it doesn't drain very well, and had some equipment on the lawn. Bottom line is it destroyed the lawn. So we tried reseeding it in October, and then we had tons of rain, and I think a lot of the seed got washed away. At this point, it's growing in sparsely. I guess my question is, should we put compost down, put some new topsoil down, reseed it, put straw?
No straw ever. Do you know what type of seed you sowed back in the fall, late fall, a little too late, but it seems like you were constrained by physical reality, and sun or shade?
It's fairly sunny, and I think we put some rye down.
Oh, that's interesting. And perennial rye, right? Not annual rye.
Correct.
That's an interesting choice. That's kind of in the middle ground. I don't mind that at all.
Okay.
You're wasting your time to try to sow seed in the spring. It just will not work in your region. So what Nick Christians, our in-house lawn care expert from Iowa State University, would say is just try and be satisfied with what you have over the summer. Because anything you do in spring is going to need to be redone in the fall. So budget that money for doing the job well in the fall.
Okay.
In the meantime, whatever comes up, just cut it high. Don't worry if it's grass or weeds. Nature abhors a vacuum. You'll get enough green growth out there to get by. And then what I suggest you do, because you're all done the construction, right?
Yes.
Mid-July, start getting ready. Tear it up. Really till it up. And get out there on nice days and rake out as much of the green material as you can. And then around early August, You want to get a big load of yard waste compost delivered. Spread that an inch or two thick on top of your base, and then level that out, but try not to disturb it. Do not till again. By not tilling and covering the surface of the tilled soil, you should keep any weed seeds from germinating. So by putting the 2 inches of yard waste compost, which should be widely available in your area, on top, you'll have a perfect germination bed, and it should be weed-free.
Okay.
Then you just spread the seed. You can get a drop spreader, a broadcast spreader. You can do it like Johnny Appleseed. And then after it's all down, just go over the area with a rake and raking the material until most of the seed is covered by the compost and from you stepping on it. And then you want to set up gentle sprinklers to give it a nice hour-long watering first thing in the morning and then last thing in the evening. And in that time of year, mid-August to mid-September, the grass should be up and growing and thriving within a week. As soon as you have a nice stand of green material, stop watering in the evening. Never water in the evening again. Keep watering in the morning if we don't get rain. You know, every other day, back off a little bit. Until finally, when you've got a nice stand of green out there, just give it a good long soaking in the morning once a week. Cut it when it gets to be 3.5 inches high, but don't cut more than 1/2 inch off. The only thing you need to do in the fall is get any leaves off it, and I would recommend you use a leaf blower set on reverse to suck them up so you don't disturb the new grass. The grass will continue to grow all fall. It'll develop a healthy root system over the winter. By the time we get to spring, you're going to have a lawn that magazines want to come and take a picture of.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Jar. Good luck.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and warn all our listeners that my big springtime tour is about to begin. I'll be going all over the country to talk to great gardeners this spring. So if I come to your area, make sure you come out and see me or get out of town real fast, whichever is your choice. But don't you go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and what to do when powdery mildew comes a-calling. Mildewed Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible with support from Seed Savers Exchange, whose 2011 Heirloom Seed Catalog, offering nearly 600 varieties, is now available. Learn more at seedsavers.org.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, there is no stranger disease than powdery mildew. Both the causes and the cures are different than any other plant disease, so you won't want to miss the question of the week. And you won't. All you have to do is stay tuned through more fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Nancy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How are you?
I am doing just fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, Mike.
Where are you, Nance?
I'm in Allentown, Pennsylvania.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Nancy in Allentown?
I have a sand cherry, a very small sand cherry tree in my yard. I moved into this home about 4 years ago, and the tree was planted up against the house. There was not a lot of growth. It was a very small, petite tree. So I decided to move it to create a bed in the middle of the front lawn and put it in the middle of the bed, which I did. That was about 2.5 years ago. And since that time, the sand cherry has grown, has developed more branches, but it's all lopsided. It's all one-sided. I wasn't sure how to encourage growth to the other end of the tree. I also happen to have some grubs in that bed, which I treated twice with some nematodes because I've had the Japanese beetles attack the tree.
Oh, yeah. They love every type of cherry tree.
Oh, do they? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
that is one of their prime targets. People think of roses. People with cherry trees and grapevines know that the rose is just an appetizer.
How about that?
So okay. that's not a sign of weakness on the tree. That's just mm-hmm. like a prime steak with baked potatoes to a Japanese beetle.
I see. Well, they have. They have loved this tree for the last 3 years.
The problem with Japanese beetles, especially with a plant like this that they're highly attracted to, is you can't control them on your own property. They're going to fly in from up to a mile away. So it is absolutely crucial not to use Japanese beetle traps
right.
anywhere on your property because you'll
okay.
bring them in. Give the traps to all your neighbors. Actually, you know what? Get a single Japanese beetle trap. Set it up. Inspect
okay.
it every day. The day you find the first beetle in it. How tall is this tree?
You know what? It's 5'9".
Good, good, good. That's a good size for a girl. I like that. It's easy to dance with, you know, wears clothes well. When you see that first beetle in the trap, take the trap down, wrap it in plastic, and hide it in the basement. And then cover the tree with sheer curtains or a spun polyester fabric row cover, which you can get at any bigger, better independent garden center. And leave that cover on for 2 weeks while the beetles establish their feeding territory around you. If they can't get to the tree during that initial emergence period, they won't be interested in it later on because they won't be able to implant their pheromones on it. And once they've established that feeding territory, they don't move around as much. So believe it or not, after 2 weeks, you can take this cover off and your Japanese beetle damage will be nothing to minimal.
Okay.
Now, you moved this plant yourself.
Well, I had someone do it. I had landscape, designing people do it.
Did you watch them?
No, I did not.
Okay, so you don't know if they dug up a big root ball or anything like that?
No, I don't know that, but they planted a couple of other trees for me, and those trees have been doing very well.
Good, good. Do you know what time of year it was moved?
It was moved in the spring.
Okay,
in
good.
Late spring.
Good.
Early
well,
spring.
Okay, early spring is much better than late spring because these things do take heat stress badly.
Oh, wait a minute. You know what? I take that back. It was actually moved in, I had this initial work done in the fall, in November.
Even better. Even better. The trees
okay.
sound asleep. And they didn't plant it too deeply. It's not a lollipop, and they didn't mound mulch up against the trunk.
It's a substantial bed, and it's in the middle of the bed, so the mulch is it's up against the trunk. I
okay. That's probably what's killing the tree. Landscapers are promulgating the worst thing in horticulture today, which is this trend of decorative mulching. You never see it in nature. Nature never touches the trunk of a tree with anything. You see that dramatic root flare getting into the ground. Hoe the mulch away from the trunk of any tree. And if it's just cheap shredded wood mulch, I would really try to get away from it and use no more because it's eventually going to stain your home and kill your plants. And you say one side of the tree appears to be dead?
No, well, there's just no growth on the one side. It's as if the branches have gravitated toward the sun all to one side, and yet I know the sun shines on the other side of the tree. It's in the middle of a yard that gets a lot of sun.
Does the tree leaf out evenly?
It's got lots of leaves, but they're all on the one side. They're all in one direction.
I fear that one side of the tree may be dead, Nance.
Yeah.
Any branch that goes through a spring without leaves and flowers is a dead branch and should be removed. And if that leaves you with a lopsided tree, well, then maybe it's time to replace it. Because it sounds like a dwarf tree that's very, very appropriate for a small landscape. It probably has been planted poorly. Landscapers, I'm sorry, they have a bad habit of planting trees too deeply. It is their biggest cardinal sins as a profession. So try to get away from the wood mulch. Immediately rescue the trunks of your trees because over this winter, mice and voles and insects and rot will use that cover to attack the trunk. Watch how it leafs out in the spring. Remove any branches that don't leaf out. Take them off completely, but leave the collar where the branch meets the tree, attached to the tree, and then take a good look at the tree. Perhaps there's something you can do on the other side to even it out. But if when you've removed the dead branches, you decide you don't like how it looks, and then bite the bullet, get a nice specimen, Make sure it's planted high. Don't mulch it with anything other than compost. Don't even let the compost touch the trunk. And you'll have a good-sized sand cherry again before you know it.
Okay, Mike. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Well, thank you and good luck.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Bob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. How are you today?
I am fine. Bob, how are you, sir?
I'm doing very well, thank you. I am in Hazlet, New Jersey, which is central Jersey near the coast. So I moved in our house about 4 years ago, and along the side of the house were some really nice lilac bushes. They stood about 5 or 6 foot tall. I topped them off a little bit before they turned green in the springtime and got a nice coverage and a nice bloom out of them the last couple of years. They've started to look very woody, some dead stems within it, and it's starting to look pretty thin and ugly.
I would not have topped them.
Okay.
There are very few plants that take their growing tip being removed well. Now, there are some. There are herbaceous perennials that grow like weeds, like butterfly bush,
yes,
that you can cut back strongly in the spring, and they thrive on it. Ornamental grasses are another example. Lilacs are very prone to disease, and it doesn't sound like you have that problem, so you're in good shape. And depending on how old they are, I wouldn't be surprised that some of the older growth is starting to get woody on you. Here's what I want you to do.
Okay.
Leave them alone. Wait till they bloom again this spring. As they bloom, if you see any old woody branches that don't have any flowering parts on them, you can remove those while the flowers are still on the other branches. In fact, this is an old horticulturalist secret of showing off the flowers by removing non-flowering plant parts after you've seen where all the flowers are going to set. You really make yourself look like a genius. You look like you manufactured more flowers when all you did is remove the non-flowering parts.
Okay.
So every year, you can remove up to 25% of the plant's mass every spring in the form of the oldest and woodiest branches. And that way, over the course of a few years, you'll naturally rejuvenate the plant into having more of the kind of lush, younger growth. But this is a very common thing. I do this with my forsythia, for instance. Some of this stuff turns into small trees over time. I wait till it finishes blooming, and then that's the stuff I remove. And it's interesting because you can really get the look you want if you time it right and if you do it over the course of a few seasons.
Okay.
If you get too nuts and do too much at once, then you could kill the plant or ruin the plant. You never want to prune it any other time than after the flowers have appeared. But you should be able to coax them into a look that you'll be very happy with.
Excellent.
All right, Bob?
Thank you very much.
All right. Take care, man.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Dawn, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Dawn. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. And you?
I am doing okay. Where are you, Dawn?
I am in Leicester, North Carolina, just outside of Asheville in the beautiful Blue Ridge Mountains.
I know it well. I have visited there. I've spoken up there. So what can we do for you?
I am wondering about worms, primarily, and salamanders also. I have, for a long time, worried about them when they end up on the bottom of a hole, when maybe they came from near the surface, and they get a bunch of dirt thrown on top of them, and my boyfriend always says, oh, they're fine, and I'm always like, no, get them out of the hole. Because I think they die down there. If they don't have their tunnel made, how can they get out?
You're talking about when you dig a planting hole.
Yes.
And you see a worm in the hole, should you then just replace the dirt on this over top of the worm or the salamander, or should you do something different?
Correct.
Instinctively, I would have said don't worry about it. They're used to being underground. But I appreciate what you just said. about them being underground all the time in little cars, so to speak, in their little tunnels that they've made for themselves.
Right.
And now you might be compressing that a little bit too much when you tamp down the dirt to keep your new plant in place.
Well, certainly there are occasions when you do. I mean, I guess part of it is because, you know, I have kind of this project going on where I am creating raised beds, and we've taken a bunch of leaves from the woods and laid them in and then laid dirt on top and building up in layers.
Oh, no, don't do that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, your archaeologists are going to find those layers of well-preserved leaves. That doesn't work. You're creating...
Well, then we stir them up at the end of our building.
And all that does is encourage weeds. Here's what you do to build a raised bed. You frame out the bed. You measure it out so it's no wider than 4 feet so you can reach the center of the bed without ever stepping in it again. And then you fill it up with good soil, either high quality topsoil or compost or a mix of that. When you have your fall leaves, you take those, and by whatever mechanism you can do it the most easily, you shred them up, you pile them up, and then exposed to the air and light and rainwater, they will become high quality compost, whereby if you bury them with soil on top, they become like those newspapers they reclaim out of ancient landfills where you can still read the headlines on papers from the 50s because there's no oxygen down there.
Even if you stir them up and kind of leave it as a long-term bed, like it's composting and you're not going to plant it for a couple of years,
Let me give you the old organic gardening line. When does nature ever do such a thing? When does nature ever take whole leaves and cover it over with dirt?
But when does nature try to build a terraced bed on the side of a mountain with lush soil in them?
Well, you know, that's the terraced bed is a human invention that goes back thousands and thousands of years, and it is a way of getting around problems in nature. When we make compost and use it to fill those beds, we specifically imitate the best of nature and the perpetual motion machine that has replenished our soils and always will for untold millennia, as long as we don't try to overly improve on nature. Believe me, the results will be much better if you can make high-quality compost, get some well-screened, high-quality topsoil, fill your raised beds with that, and then you may shred up the leaves and use them as a mulch on the surface of the soil to protect your plants against drought stress and to keep weeds from germinating. And I will tell you, it's also the way to get all the earthworms in the perfect environment right underneath that layer of leaf litter, constantly replenishing that soil with their own powerful natural fertilizer in the form of worm castings. Now, I think you have some element, certainly, of being right. When you dig a plant hole and you see a worm or a salamander, something many organic gardeners will do is they'll take that worm, especially, and they'll toss it into a finished part of the garden or drop a salamander or a toad into a shady spot in a garden with a lot of plants on it where they may take up habitat there and eat your garden pests for you. It is the least possible risk to the organism, and I think you may be correct that should you tamp down soil too much or around a worm or a salamander, you may cut off their oxygen and accidentally damage them or shorten their lifespan.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Mike.
A pleasure to speak to someone who cares so much about their worms and salamanders. One of my favorite creatures. We really haven't discussed them in depth on the show, but they are as beneficial and to some degree as garden toads, tremendous insect eaters. And again, most people never see them because they stay in damp, shady spots during the day and come out and do their hunting at night.
That's one more thing is when we do collect leaves from the woods to add to the compost pile or to my ill-prepared beds, as it turns to find out, when we take them from damp where the leaves are more decomposed, which I have preferred.
Right. Yeah, because nature will compost those leaves over time on the surface of the soil.
But that's where more of the salamanders are. And if someone is taking from the woods and then shredding them, just...
No, they get away from that. That tends not to be a problem. I've seen the worms and the salamanders and toads get away from my leafac on reverse. I've never had that accident. I've had a lot of other unfortunate accidents. And even in the compost pile, the worms are very good about coming in and then getting out when it gets too hot and then going back in again. They're good in that situation. But you're right. If you press the soil down around them too much, you might harm them. That's a very nice thought. You're a good person, Dawn.
Well, maybe I'm a little obsessive, but thank you so much, Mike.
Obsessive in a good direction. A pleasure to speak with you, Dawn.
You too.
Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye. Oh, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody about the peculiarity of those little rosemary Christmas trees. Yes, they're fun, they're fragrant, and they are abundant around this time of year, but they tend to be as root-bound as a plant can get. So if you got one as a holiday gift or you bought one for yourself, make sure you take it out of its tiny little pot and pot it up into one twice as large. When you do this, you'll see it's all roots inside. And by repotting it into a pot twice as big, you'll allow it to take up and hold some water and have a much better chance of making it through the winter. But don't you go saving your herb of remembrance from your compost pile just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and what to do if powdery mildew comes a-calling. I'm Mildewed Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible with support from Seed Savers Exchange, whose 2011 Heirloom Seed Catalog, offering nearly 600 varieties, is now available. Learn more at seedsavers.org.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll be getting to the question of the week about powdery mildew, perhaps the strangest disease that strikes gardens. Its causes are the opposite of most diseases, and its cures are decidedly weird. You won't want to miss how you can use milk, for instance, to chase this disease away. And you won't miss it. All you got to do is listen to a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Kathy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, hello. Thank you for so much for taking our call from the Pinelands in South Jersey.
All right. Very good, Kathy. Thank you for making your call from the Pinelands in South Jersey with your nasty, miserable, sandy soil.
I know. Well, of course, being in the Pinelands, we bought a little log cabin 5 years ago. It's on 5 acres, of course, all pine trees. And the person who built this cabin 25 years ago also put up beautiful white birch. The problem comes with my husband, who, A, wants to cut down all the pines in front of the house because he says the grass won't grow, which is fine with me. And he wants to cut all the little baby sprouts coming up from the bottom of the white birches, which I told him he shouldn't cut. So the question is two questions. Are the pines suffocating the birches? Are the pines prohibiting the grass from growing? And do we need to cut the baby sprouts from coming up at the bottom of the birches?
In reverse.
Okay.
Most people do encourage you to remove those, quote, water sprouts coming up from the base of the birch trees. These are relatively useless plant parts. They don't do the mother plant any good. They do suck energy from it. But if you cut them, you stimulate a hormone that makes them regrow. If you go to our website, if you go to youbetyourgarden.org and go to Garden Answers A to Z and go to S for suckers or W for water sprouts, you'll see some advice on how to snap those water sprouts off at the soil line. And believe it or not, when you snap them, as opposed to cutting them, it does not stimulate that production of the regrowth hormone. So if he's been cutting them, the hormone forces the plant to regrow them, so it's an endless cycle.
But either way, he's right, see, because I've been telling him he shouldn't, and he keeps saying he should, and we're having big arguments now, so maybe you've solved an argument, and I'm going to have to go tell him I have egg on my face now.
No. Kathy, come on. A broken watch is right twice a day, you know.
Well, that's wonderful news. What about the pines, the beautiful pinelands? I didn't move in the pinelands in this beautiful log cabin to cut my pine trees down just so I can have grass.
You are 100% correct in that. It's unusual that a husband is ever right about anything, but they're, you know, again, I mean, you're blindfolded. You're going to hit the board with a dart every once in a while. It ain't called the Pinelands because lawns grow beautifully there. That is the kind of plant that has thrived there. It can take those inhospitable soil conditions. Yes, it's difficult to grow grass around trees for many reasons, but you can also neither grow grass in sand. He would have to import a lot of compost, and I mean massive biblical amounts, to establish a lawn out there.
I think you're right. I told him that, and a lot of water, and we want to conserve water, even though we're on an aquifer with a well, but still it's the electric that you have to pump up the water to water the grass, and I think it would be a Herculean task to even try to keep it watered.
The best you could ever hope to do is mix enough organic matter into the sand to allow the grass to grow. You are, again, entirely correct in that because of the high sand content, it would not retain moisture, and the water needs of the lawn would be excessive. The pines are what belongs there. This is not an area for lawns, but I will say that if you want to establish a nice little raised bed garden, then you have these isolated, dedicated areas where you can improve the soil with lots of compost, and then you have an ideal situation. You have a rich soil that drains well to grow flowers and bedding plants and, you know, summertime tomatoes and stuff like that. But a lawn would be a fairly huge mistake in that region.
Well, thank you so much. And can I go to your website to know what a raised garden is? Because that sounds like a good compromise, that he can have a raised garden and I can just keep my beautiful pine trees.
Absolutely. If you go to youbetyourgarden.org, like I said, and go to R for raised beds,
okay,
you'll see all the building instructions. And I can tell you that although your sand can be a real problem, it also drains well, and it's much easier to build a raised bed in sandy soil than it is in clay soil.
Thank you, Mike.
All right, Kathy. Bye. Thank you. 1-888-346-9499. Mike, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike. How are you?
I'm good. Mike, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you very much.
And where is the other Mike?
I'm in Upper East Tennessee, Bristol, Tennessee.
Oh, my good friends in the Tri-Cities. I'll be visiting there shortly now. I'll be at the Virginia Garden Fair this spring. I'm looking forward to my return.
I'll look that up, and I'll be up there to see you.
Very good. Very good. What can we do for you right now?
I moved into a home. I'm right smack dab on the river. I'm sitting here. I'm sitting in my car right now. I'm about 6 feet from the South Holston River. And I kept having, you know, I was having a sewer problem. And I'm so close, I can't really do field lines. I would have to pump and all that kind of stuff. So
you'd have to build a sand mound.
That won't even work. It won't perk.
Oh, okay. Right.
I'm too close.
You're not on a city sewer system of any kind.
No, none.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's tough. All right, so what's your question?
Well, it turned out not to be so tough. I went with a composting toilet.
We used to have an ad for those things in the classified section of every issue of organic gardening. So
right.
I know they must have been selling. And we do have a lot of proponents out there of what's called Humanure. And people with these systems in their house, you use worms, right? There's worms down in a base, and they take what you give them and they turn it into the equivalent of rich compost. And it's a freestanding unit. It's not connected to anything. There's never any, quote, waste to dump. Whatever effluent water comes from your house is just gray water from washing.
I get about a gallon of excess because the company that I went with is called Sunmar. I've got a gallon jug, and it's not full, and I've had my composting toilet for almost 3 years now.
And do you use the result to feed your lawn or some landscape plants or something?
I certainly do. I put it on all my flowers. You can put it on your food plants, but the company says, you know, people don't know really how to use it, so we would rather not recommend it.
It's a delicate topic. I'm sure we've lost a couple of listeners along this path. But I will tell you, when I became the editor of Organic Gardening, there were four or five classic books I was reading. One was Sir Albert Howard's An Agricultural Testament, which is The Secret Origin of Composting. The other is a book called Farmers of 40 Centuries, and it's about the evolution of agriculture in
right.
China, and how China supported itself without famine for, you know, 40 centuries by recycling everything, including the human waste. But I'm with you. I've always been fascinated by these things. I always thought it would be fun to have one in the house. And, of course, my wife just gives me the look whenever I say that and taps her foot on the ground. But I would probably keep it on ornamentals as well, just for the heck of it, because I've got enough of the other compost. But you're happy with yours, and you would recommend it to any other listener who...
Highly recommend.
And
yes.
It sounds like in your situation, you're an environmental hero. I mean, you making this little financial contribution by investing in this, and it's not even machinery. It's a very natural system. But Lord knows how much good you're doing for that waterway right outside.
Matter of fact, I bought 3 units so I could become a dealer. You know, I've sold one to my friend, and I've got two, and they're just great.
It gives all new meaning to the term pyramid scheme now, doesn't it? There's an image for you, Mike.
Well, I don't make any money on them. I present them. I'm chairman of the Lake and River Cleanup Committee here in Bristol. I've done it for about 8 years. But, you know, I use no water whatsoever.
Right, because they're waterless.
They're waterless. Another question I wanted to ask you, not to change the subject, I live in the woods, and I used to burn all my leaves.
Why?
Well, because I was stupid. I have got the most beautiful dirt from my leaves and my composting toilet. It is the prettiest stuff you have ever seen. It's just beautiful.
Yes. Not only do you waste all of their inherent nutrition and the energy when you burn leaves, because unlike when you burn wood in a fireplace, you're not collecting that energy, that heat that's being given off.
Right.
But the ash that you have left over is virtually useless in most garden situations because it's so highly alkaline, whereby the leaves, once they break down, they are the fertilizer that has taken care of plants on this planet, forget for 40 centuries, probably
right.
for as long as plants have been in existence.
Right.
But sounds like you're a good steward of your environment
steward.
There, Mike. All right. Well, thank you. That's great to hear. Thank you for the raves about your composting friend. And I'll see you when I come down to the Tri-Cities, okay?
Okay, buddy. Take care.
You too, man.
Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Tell powdery mildew to take a powder. Our question this week comes from Jason in Southwest Virginia, who writes, "Dear Mike, our garden was hit with late blight on tomatoes and powdery mildew on squash, gourds, and melons. We ripped out the tomato vines and used neem oil and milk spray on the powdery mildew. My question is about next year's garden. We won't plant tomatoes in the same place, of course. But is there anything else you would recommend to stop the blight and mildew before they get a foothold? Well, it's always good to grow your tomatoes in a different spot, Jace, but it has nothing to do with the dreaded late blight that struck so many gardens last season. Rotating tomatoes is primarily done to avoid soil-borne wilts. Ah, but rotation is recommended for powdery mildew prevention, especially on those vining plants you name. Even more important are sanitation and cleanup. promptly remove affected plants at the end of the season, and remove and destroy any mulches that were near them. Those mulches are harboring fungal spores that could well get things going again. But the spores that cause powdery mildew can still blow in from other gardens, and often do. They're very prevalent in the environment. So provide lots of airflow around those vines during the growing season. Leave extra room between the plants and trellis or otherwise support them. It can be impossible to avoid disease on sprawling plants in a crowded garden. And growing up allows you to give the plants more breathing room in the same or even smaller footprint. Again, most mulches are notorious for harboring disease spores. Wood and bark are the worst. And even though they're one of my favorites, shredded fall leaves should also be avoided when you're trying to get through at least one symptom-free season to break the cycle of disease. Compost is the ideal mulch. A 1 to 2 inch layer of compost on the surface of the soil feeds your plants, prevents weeds, and provides a hostile home for spores looking to breed. High-quality compost contains living organisms that eat disease spores as soon as they land. Now, unlike other diseases like anthracnose, downy mildew, and almost all the others, powdery mildew can occur in dry conditions. And although it seems counterintuitive, British researchers reporting in the journal Plant Pathology found that rinsing the whitish-gray powder off your plants with sharp sprays of water can be a surprisingly effective cure. Just be aware that wetting leaves will make other diseases worse, so make sure you have powdery mildew and do the wetting in the AM only. Now, I like Jason's use of neem oil, as the oil form of this plant seed is a very effective antifungal. In another harder-to-find form, neem acts as an anti-feedant, and if pest insects eat anyway, they die. You go, neem tree seed! And although you may be scratching your heads at Jason's mention of milk, he's on the money with that one as well. I've always wondered who figured this out. But a 10% milk solution sprayed on affected leaves beats chemical fungicides in controlled studies of powdery mildew remedies. To try this at home, mix 9 parts water with 1 part skim milk and spray affected leaves well in the morning, trying to coat both sides. If the disease progresses, despite your use of milk, neem, or the other remedies we'll mention in a moment, cut your losses by destroying the affected plants before they can make the rest of your garden sick. We conclude with a similar question. I've been plagued by powdery mildew on my floribunda and hedge roses for several years. I've also had it on my lilacs, which are nowhere near my roses. I was close to giving up last year, although I love my roses and have tended them for 15 years. Please help. I don't have the ability to make my own compost. Signed, Distressed in Salisbury, Maryland. Well then, buy some compost, Distressed, as it is essential in helping those two disease-prone plants fight infection. You even seem to know this by your mention of compost at the end of your email. And you live in Maryland, home to the great Leaf Grow program that takes all the state's leaves and turns them into a widely available premium compost. You Marylanders have easier access to high-quality compost than listeners in virtually any other state. Now, if you're pruning your roses in the fall, stop. Wait until they begin growing again in the spring. Prune them then. Get rid of any old mulch along with the prunings and lay an inch of compost on the surface of the soil as your new disease-preventing mulch. Remove any mulch from under those lilacs as well and replace it with compost as soon as possible in the spring. Obviously, you want to wait until after the lilacs have bloomed to prune them. When you do, try to open up their center. And if they're crowded by other plants, prune or remove some of those air stoppers over the winter if you can. Now, if disease appears anyway, compost tea or the Cornell formula might work better here than the cures we've already mentioned. They also work well on other kinds of plant diseases. You'll find all the details on those helpful things in some previous questions of the week that we'll link up to with this one. Well, those sure were some great and extremely weird solutions for powdery mildew problems now, weren't they? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To carefully review this week's edition, just visit the You Bet Your Garden section of GardensAlive.com. Oh no, our producers are threatening to spray me with a double latte if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched, refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Visit our new and improved website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the Gardens Live Question of the Week, find the answers to all your garden problems in our alphabetized archive of answers, listen to this show and old shows over your computer, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineers this week have been Al Banks and Fred Snyder. Rich Banowitz and Matt Campbell are our powder-free webmasters. Our disease-resistant intern is the admirable Alejandro Torres. Our show is produced by Alexis Landis and Alex Yocker. I'm mildly mildewed Mike McGrath, and I'll see you next week. Just what can you accomplish with a greenhouse? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll explain the big difference between freestanding and attached and the types of tricks any greenhouse will do best. Plus your fabulous phone calls.